All right, folks, welcome back to Plot Pit. I am your host, William Atkinson, here with co-host John LeMay and local author Beverly Coots. Hello, Beverly.
Hello, William.
Today in the pit, we are talking about romance, an Alaskan gold mine, and possibly, if we get to it, a leprechaun. Let's begin the descent. Beverly, introduce yourself for our listeners.
Okay, I'm Beverly Coots. I write fiction and largely clean fiction. I I'm an engineer and a farmer and a dog sap and a mother, a grateful mother. I have a wonderful son.
So today in prep for the show, what I ended up doing is going out to one of my favorite sources, as our listeners know, chroniclingamerica.gov, and I searched for romance as a term. And I came out with a couple of different articles. The first is out of a journal called The Daybook, July 18, 1916. Headline, Sister Must Bear Her Shame to Defend Brother Who Killed Man. This is specifically coming off of page 13 of a 32-page journal. That's our first bit for today. The second one also comes out of the same journal, The Daybook, but this one's dated May 3rd, 1912, page 13. And then I have probably the more interesting of the two, and we'll get to why shortly, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. And this is Tuesday, February 20, 1900. Headline, New Alaskan Goldfields. And it looks like this was hand-drawn. So the thoughts today for the show are, how are we going to tie these particular articles or elements of the articles in such a fashion as to tell something that might be suitable for Valentine's? Now, Beverly, you have something in front of you here about the etymology of romance. Why don't you go for that?
Yeah. So romance is not, it's not just a word that we use today to mean potboiler or bodice ripper as a book. It's actually a whole world of more common narratives that that take into account our natural appetites, our sexual appetites, our appetites for love, our appetites for heroic adventure, and great quests or romances. So there are many older authors, and in fact, the authors of some of these articles speak about romance in the old-fashioned way, which includes that heroic quest and kind of a little more common versus an elite highbrow type of look at life. So think Pulp Fiction.
Ooh, I love Pulp Fiction. John, that's something you and I do a lot.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So one of the things that really pops out to me in the use of romance, particularly for the article about the Alaskan gold mine, is latching on to that more general term of what romance really is as an epic adventure or a love for something, not necessarily what we might consider in today's romantic comedy of, you know, the lovey-dovey initial phases of courtship. So here's what we've got out of the Alaskan gold mine thing. It's kind of based in Nome, Alaska, and it's from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Tuesday, February 20, 1900, Special Cape Nome Edition, which I thought was kind of cool. And it's specifically titled, headline right across, written in what appears to be like hand-drawn font, New Alaskan Goldfields. And so, quote, coming right out of it, going into this more broad sense of what the term romance really is, every great mining camp has had an atmosphere of romance, a certain grim uniqueness, and a pioneering history punctuated with the crime of Cain. Yet, strange to say, not a murder was committed at Cape Nome last year, despite the bitterness of feeling and the ugly passions aroused in the controversies over location rights. Now, I really particularly like the verbiage of punctuated with the crime of Cain, and for those that, you know, are aware, they're referencing the old Genesis story of Cain and Abel there. And it goes on throughout this article, kind of discussing a little bit about the abundance of gold in this particular region, and a little bit in the contrast of, because it's so abundant and there are so few people, they're not really fighting over resources as it relates to the mining issues. So, quote, the spirit of equality or regard for relative rights prevailed till the winter set in. Not only were no lives lost in the brothel quarrels or contentions over property, but thievery was scarcely heard of. And that human conglomerate of the mining camp, the footpad, never put in an appearance. Now, I found this particularly interesting because there's a song coming out of 1961, Johnny Horton, North to Alaska.
Yes.
And you've got this gentleman named Sam and then his brother, and it's based in like 1890-something going into the early 1902, talking about this particular gold rush that's going on in Alaska. And the lyrics of this particular verse that I'm going to pull out here, George turned to Sam with his gold in his hand, said, "Sam, you're looking at a lonely, lonely man." So now we have kind of this romance tied to Nome. And I don't know if Johnny Horton actually read this particular article, but right. Sam's lonely. And he says, "I'll trade all the gold that's buried in this land for one small band of gold to place on sweet little Jenny's hand."
Oh.
So what we have here is an individual sung of in this song, of a historical figure that's part of this gold rush in Alaska, and he's willing to give up all the gold for love, like something true. And I just thought that that was kind of really cool when you put all of this together with the oftentimes modern pop idea of the magic that comes with, you know, a romance. In the Nome article a little bit later, actually the term magical is used, and it also uses the term rainbows and an ice-locked pot of gold. Mm. Quote, "The conflicting reports heard there discouraged the majority from chasing any more rainbows in the direction of an ice-locked pot of gold." And I'm thinking, out of all of this, quote, "The growth of the city was magical." So that was where the magical thing comes in. You got rainbows, you got magic, you've got a pot of gold. Instantly, my head went to leprechauns.
Sounds good to me. Although, that could wait until March if you want to.
And kind of a little off to the side, if we chose to use it for a story, quote, "More remarkable still and stimulating to the dullest imagination are the possibilities of the vast stretch of the marshy plain known as tundra, which lies beneath the sea or between the sea and mountains." Mm. And so the note that I have there is what lurks in the marsh.
Oh.
Now, moving on to the other two articles, we have a love affair gone wrong, a man ends up murdered, and then we also end up with another article where this woman takes out her ex-lover and riddles him with bullets. So you've got the, you know, jealousy thing going on. What would we do with this to tell a story suitable for Valentine's Day?
Well, what I notice in all three articles is man's passion for life, right? So, and passion to live it well. That's what drives the will to succeed, the will to have money, the will to have means. And in one of these articles, and I can't remember which one, the woman is an immigrant. But in her original country, she had this sordid love affair, and the man didn't marry her. In fact, he moved to America and married someone else. And she ended up being married and moving to America, where he chased her down again and tried to reinsert himself into her life. What all that comes out in these bits is this, the passion nature of the relationship. In the third article as well, where the brother steps in to protect his sister's honor, he kills out of familial love for his sister. He does not want her her reputation tainted because of an earlier affair. So we've got all these affairs, and we've got all this passion, and we've got gold. So for me, putting those things together, you're looking at several different types of love. Love of money, love of life, prosperity, and love between a man and a woman. Passionate love like that. So I'm thinking that we take this story in the direction of a love on the beach where the gold was.
Now, that's an interesting idea, especially when you consider this is a beach in Alaska.
Yeah, could so be cold.
It could be cold. It's, you know, not your swinging in a hammock between two palm trees with a margarita.
Right.
So you mentioned the song North to Alaska earlier, and it's funny.
Yeah, 1961, Johnny Horton.
Okay, and see, my mind went straight to the movie with John Wayne, North to Alaska and Capucine.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Kind of a light little action comedy romance, just like McClintock.
Okay.
Can't exactly remember the plot of it. You know, it's just your typical John Wayne. He fights other guys and has a hard time getting the girl, and then it all works out. And I'm sure gold was in there somewhere. So I'm thinking of now, though, I'm thinking of something similar to Romancing the Stone with, Kathleen Turner and Michael Douglas?
Excellent film, yeah.
So I'm thinking of this woman who goes to the Alaskan gold frontier, and then her brother murders whoever it was to protect her, and then the poor brother probably gets arrested and put in jail, and then she falls in with the rough and tumble guy that she thinks she doesn't like. You know, the typical thing, you know, to her, he's too much, or he's... You know, he's a brute, and then they have to go on this adventure together for the gold, maybe do something to prove that the brother's killing of the other man was justified, and like help him get out of jail or something, and it's tied into the quest of the gold somehow. I don't know.
I think maybe her love interest is kind of brutish, but he has a gang of ne'er-do-wells that are fabulously you know, they have a fabulous sense of right and wrong, even though they're sort of reprobates. And they actually spring her brother from jail. And then they all have this crazy dance on the beach where they're kicking up gold.
Oh, that's cool. Kicking up gold. That's interesting. That's a good visual.
Yeah. Especially considering the Nome, Alaska story and the general sense of how abundant it was and easy to get. One of the things in that article from the truth standpoint is that, you know, coming out of Seattle, apparently there was a large distrust that this gold rush was real. And there was a sense within the community in Seattle that this was all orchestrated as fiction from these individuals or companies that were part of the supply chain to travel to Alaska. I don't know if that would fit into this story, but if we've got this woman who's in Alaska, she falls in with this group or this man who has a group of rough and tumble type friends, but they have a sense of moral duty. I think that fits with the article a little bit, considering that the original story, this is the one of the sister who has to go to bat for her brother. So this is the man talking about the individual that he killed because of what happened between him and his sister, even though his sister's husband was willing to forgive and forget. So this is the lover that basically got knocked off. He says, quote, "This man was the enemy of all womankind. My sister is not to blame. He hypnotized her. I know what he wanted. He wished to send her into white slavery. And when she told me everything, I went to tell him he must leave this part of the country or I would kill him. He drew his gun first, but I might have killed him anyway." And then it goes on and it talks a little bit about his faith drove him to do this. And so this is where that higher sense of morality can come into play, especially if you've got, if he's kind of well-respected within the community in Nome. And as a result, yeah, he gets tossed in jail, broken out by this group of individuals who go to bat for him. But why, if he is so respected, my question then goes to answering, would the community actually have thrown him in jail in the first place, knowing what he did to a guy who was of less rapport?
Well, I think the guy who was of less rapport actually had some pull in the community. And he was part of a more corrupt legal system then, and that's part of why the rogues and the reprobates who are out there digging for gold are declaring their own sort of law, because they're seeking for a stronger conformity to what's right and what's wrong instead of what sells and what doesn't sell. And I've got a second point. You were talking about leprechauns. So the end of the Alaska article talks about how the territory wanted to know how Alaska was actually going to, whether or not that gold could belong to people or if it belonged in the United States, the property rights of the beach and all that kind of stuff. I think the leprechauns own the beach. That's mm-hmm. what I think. And they're going to kick up dirt in the second half of the novel. And they're actually tuned into the old form of government. So there's this whole band of merry gangsters that takes on the leprechauns. And, you know, that's how the town actually magically grew, is because of the leprechauns. And so there's these sort of, you know, leprechauns aren't necessarily good. They're kind of ornery and they're expedient for their own sake. So I'm thinking maybe there's a whole sort of legal and political side to this romance, and passions are aroused. Leprechauns are very passionate about gold. So I think this could work.
And then I'm thinking, and in addition to or opposed to leprechauns, the frost giants from Norse mythology, too, could come into play.
Ooh.
Maybe they just think the leprechauns are the bad guys, but then they have to team up with the leprechauns to fight the even more dangerous frost giants.
Ooh, and so an unnatural balance mm-hmm. is held.
Yeah.
And maybe they both change for the better.
Yeah.
The leprechauns and the somewhat bawdy miners.
Which could explain why you would traditionally expect there to be property rights issues and conflicts leading to unfortunate deaths and bar brawls or just other conflicts of interest. Whereas in this particular setting, the article specifically notes that there were no such conflicts.
Right.
So the article that coming out of the Seattle Intelligencer could be placed at the end of our story, whereas the other events that we're talking about are actually taking place, say, a couple of years prior at the onset mm-hmm. of all of this, you know, when the gold mine or this field of gold is discovered at the foothills of Nome in the late 1800s.
Or the article could be placed at the beginning and it could be a lie. By the government, the powers, the authorities that are in charge. They're trying to lure people there. Their town is magically growing, and they're lying about how great it is.
Which would fit also with the article's note of the distrust.
Yeah.
So whoever's writing this article has maybe inside information and could be trying to dissuade people from going, even though he's supposed to, based upon, you know, being threatened or whatever.
So he is. So maybe those articles and the news that spread to dissuade people was a sideways attempt to keep people from running into that wall of corrupt government governing. Whether or not it's a full government, I don't know. That would be up to the writer. But
so we have the potential to take this into the Norse mythology with the frost giants, the leprechaun mythology, but that's based largely out of Ireland. My thought to connect leprechauns to Alaska was back way, way, way when you've got this ornery leprechaun who's kind of ostracized from his people for whatever reason, and he decides, all right, screw you guys, I'm taking my ball and I'm going home. And he takes all of his gold and travels the world and lands in Alaska just trying to get away from everybody. And maybe it could have been set on with the idea that everybody was just looking for gold and all the leprechauns didn't like this one leprechaun. And so all of the tricks that they would play to keep people from stealing their gold at the end of the rainbow was to redirect them to this other leprechaun's gold. And he gets fed up with all of it. And that's what drives him out and travels the world. He ends up in Alaska, kind of, you know, settling down or whatever. Or maybe there's not enough, or he feels ostracized from the ability to actually find a mate or a companion or a friend in his... So he starts traveling the world for other leprechauns for some reason. So we've got the idea of, you know, kind of the fantasy realm that we could tie this into. We've got the dystopian idea in the idea that this is all a facade. For whatever reason, you've got this undercurrent of corruption that's really trying to push people out into the foothills of Nome to mine for some unknown reason. And we've got a mystery at our hands with potentially the journalist that's covering all of this trying to feed information to the public. So that could be more of a reality-based. And with the last, I don't know, 7-8 minutes, what would we like to do to tell, you know, one of those stories?
I think you start with the movement to Nome. I think that, so basically they're going on a quest and they get up, the sister and the brother get up there and they encounter all of this trouble and strife, but they encounter real gold as well. And I think that there's a second, an underlying minor element in the leprechaun's fleeing and trying to establish his own. Not only does he love gold, but he'd like a mate. And so he ends up with a whole family that he's very protective of, but they have claimed the beach. So there's that sort of tension built in. And then I need to know more about the snow.
The ice, frost giants.
Frost giants. I don't know much about that.
I'm usually pretty up on mythology, but that one, I'm ashamed to say, just comes from Kenneth Branagh's Thor movie. That's it.
Oh, okay.
But I know they're a real thing from Norse mythology, and they're big, you know, as opposed to leprechauns that are little. And I think I just went with them because we're in a snowy area, basically.
Okay.
But yeah, I oddly enough, though, the one who usually likes to go the fantasy route, I'm more this time wanting to ground it and keep the magical creatures out of it and just do like a typical adventure romance. And, you know, Beverly, you were talking about a flash forward. So now I'm thinking, okay, you flash forward with the murder of the guy who's supposedly doing wrong to the woman by the brother. Then maybe you flash back. And I thought it would be interesting, what if instead the brother was the bad guy and he just didn't want her to be with this guy and he murdered him, and it's actually a tragic love story and that's the bad ending to it, that he was actually a good guy and he made up all these lies about him. So it's like just a tragic romance.
Ooh.
You know, I could buy into that. It almost has a little bit of The Fall of House of Usher mm-hmm. from Edgar Allan Poe in it. So you could go in a really kind of twisted, sort of dark romance, tragic scenario mm-hmm. where this brother is extremely jealous of his sister for whatever reason.
Or it's kind of incestuous on his part where he's in love with her.
Yes, we could go that route.
Yeah, we could. We could go all Greek.
Ultimately, the underlying tone, I think, would be he is in love with his sister. Maybe not sexually, you know, or, you know, physically attracted to her, but there's a sense of protectiveness, mm-hmm. an over amount of protectiveness, or maybe a sense of jealousy, like she can just get, you know, anybody and everybody, and maybe he's the outcast of society, the black sheep for whatever reason. The particular article that we're discussing here is the one with the sister who has to defend her brother. Quote, the headline, "Sister must bear her shame to defend brother who killed man." Now, the husband here was actually willing to forgive. It was, so she has this affair. She tells her husband and her brother. The husband's like, okay, whatever, we'll just move on. The brother takes this and knocks off the other guy. If we go into that idea, it could be that the brother wants to actually knock off the husband too.
Or it's not a tragedy, and the brother was helping, and they're just faking the guy's death, and he has the gold, and then he and the girl secretly do run off together after he's faked his death with the help of the brother, and they have the gold, and they have their happy ending. It's another possibility.
And then the sequel, they run into the monster of the tundra.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, wait, no, we're not doing fantasy. I'm sorry.
Going back, okay, so here's my thought. Trying to articulate this pretty well because my head went a mile a minute and my lips could only move so fast. She has this love affair with this guy. She wants to run away with him. for whatever reason. Maybe she's trying to escape a very abusive relationship. And she thinks she can tell the husband and then he'll get mad and they'll have a divorce to free her. Well, that doesn't happen. So now the brother gets involved and comes up with the plan. Well, what let's do is we will set up a faked death, put enough strife and catastrophe into the family for whatever reason, in such a way as to where either the court system hustles everybody away in secrecy under witness protection or something, or you could have the idea that the husband just doesn't want to be a part of a murder, right, for whatever reason. And so they're thinking they can get away. As the dominoes fall, the story progresses through book one. They do get away, and then book two opens up with the scene in Alaska where you've got this guy they've actually married. They are building this house in the foothills of the mountains of Alaska, specifically the foothills of Nome.
Yeah, I like it.
And then you don't have to bathe it with any fantasy elements or anything. It does stay, you know, relatively within the realm of reality. And the article from the Seattle Intelligencer here doesn't really have a play of lurid motives or dystopian ideals or anything of that nature. It's just legitimately a tragic romance. And if you wanted to really push some aspects of this story, it could be about female empowerment or talking about, you know, the emotional abuse that some really toxic relationships can bring and how that can be extremely destructive and end up with the loss of human life or even just societal burdens with court proceedings and everything else.
Well, and they can make up their own society kind of because they are so remote and they're in Nome and how they, Alaska. So how they pitch in to be civic minded or not is, you know, it's an interesting element of that article. And then the other thing that the book might do is, since we're talking about romance, is sort of center on the major minor character of the brother who has many wants and desires. Obviously, his passions run pretty high and pretty, you know, he wears his heart on his sleeve to some extent. And how do we get him settled? Might be the second book, or do we get him settled?
That certainly could leave some opportunity for exploring the world that this builds.
Maybe he becomes the governor of Nome.
That could be really interesting. And then becomes the hero of the gold rush when it busts in some way.
Yeah. Maybe he figures out how to build on tundra.
So there you go, folks. Hope you found this valuable in your quest for writing prompts and inspiration. We are here with host
John LeMay,
who has 40 books to his name. You can catch him out on
just on Amazon, typically best place to get me.
And I'm William Atkinson. Most of everything we've talked about came from the chroniclingamerica.gov site. Wonderful source of old newspapers. There are plenty of strange stories you can harvest there. I'll leave links to the description below. And we had special guest Beverly Coots here in studio.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we have ended this episode and we'll catch you next time. You've been listening to Plot Pit.